Welcome to New World Notes, edited by yours truly, Kenneth Doust.
I've spent a while wondering what to do about this guy, George Galloway, certifiable Scotsman-American, member of Parliament of the UK, kicked out of the Labour Party for his outspoken opinions, re-elected anyway. The admirable journalist Greg Pallas has denounced Galloway as a self-promoting thief and hypocrite. On the other hand, Galloway has published a creditable rebuttal. Eventually, I decided to skip the controversy and listen to the man's words. I'm not necessarily agreeing with all of Greg Pallas's charges. Maybe Galloway doesn't spend every Saturday at the edge of town shooting puppies and assaulting Salvation Army ladies. Today we'll hear the first half of a great speech Galloway gave in November 2006 in Toronto, Canada. It's a real barn burner. It builds to a climax of indignation and then stays there. Although it was made close to 3 years ago, the speech is 100% relevant to today. Mutatis mutandis, as we smarty pants like to say. Which means just make a few minor changes of detail. The hypocritical, warmongering Prime Minister of the UK is no longer the detested Tony Blair. It's now the detested Gordon Brown. Just substitute. George Bush is no longer U.S. President. Yes, but George Bush's insane foreign policies are still in place under Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama. So when Galloway denounces Bush's foreign policies, just think American foreign policies today, which is what Galloway obviously meant in the first place. Let's have a quick review of world events just prior to Galloway's speech. In the U.S., the Democrats won a stunning victory in the congressional elections, gaining control of both houses of Congress. The election results were seen everywhere as the people's repudiation of the country's foreign policies. Note that nothing has changed, and the policies remain in place. In free, fair, and honest elections, the Palestinians had thrown out the corrupt bums that had been misgoverning them for years, the party of Yasser Arafat, and they elected the Hamas party. The U.S. and Israel immediately launched a coup and installed the corrupt bums. In the Gaza Strip, the Palestinians staged a counter-coup and installed the government they had elected. Israel, Canada, the U.S., and the U.K. then launched a crippling medieval siege and blockade of Gaza, which I believe is still pretty much in place. On the pretext that Hezbollah and Lebanon were holding four Israeli soldiers, Israel launched a massive campaign of aerial bombing of Lebanon, with the full backing and support of, and paid by, the United States. I can still hear Condoleezza Rice explaining why the United States was rejecting all calls for a ceasefire. Israel blew the civilian infrastructure of southern Lebanon to smithereens, water treatment plants, electricity plants, roads, bridges, and for some reason, dairies and dairy farms. They would later come back and give Gaza the same treatment as Lebanon for 22 days, beginning December 27, 2008. A little going-away present from Ehud Olmert and the Bush administration. The good news of 2006 was that Secretary of, quote, Defense, unquote, Donald Rumsfeld quit and went off to count his war profits. The bad news is that nothing changed but the actors, and the play went on and on. That's why George Galloway's 2006 speech is still relevant to today. I've edited it slightly for radio, and here it is.
Brothers, sisters, comrades, and friends, wassalamu alaikum. Peace be with all of you. And my thanks, first of all, to the people of this beautiful Christian church who have given over this space as part of their commitment to the justice and equity of which Ali spoke, making clear once again that whatever else is clashing in this world, this is not a clash between Christianity and the Muslims. I've just come from a TV studio, The Hour, I think it's called. We talked about Christianity and Islam. I told them, don't make the mistake of imagining that George W. Bush and Tony Blair are Christians. They blaspheme against the very idea of Jesus Christ with every policy that they pursue. Religious people, and I'm one myself, believe in the prophets, peace be upon them. Bush believes in the prophets and how to get a piece of them. Something I said at a press breakfast in Ottawa this morning seems to have captured the news, so much so that at 6 o'clock tomorrow morning on my way to the airport, I have to go to Canadian television to make a television interview about it. They seem to be very offended that I described Canadian foreign policy under Mr. Harper as absurd. Let me tell you why I think it's absurd. It's absurd to say that you're fighting for democracy in Afghanistan when you were the first government in the entire world to punish the Palestinian people with starvation because they voted for a party of which your government did not approve in the Palestinian election. That's absurd to me. It's absurd to me that Canada should wish to throw away the reputation that it had in the world, a reputation which only a few short years ago was everywhere recognized. It was seen as a country that was for peace and for development. And while other countries strode out across the world subjugating people, Canada was seen as a country that was more concerned with helping people. That was just a few short years ago. And I must tell you, I do not understand why Canada would want to join the ranks of the hated in the world. It's not in your interest, believe me, to be hated in the world. I speak as a citizen of a country which is one of the three most hated countries in the world. But when Canada, when Mr. Harper announced the beginning of a siege of the Palestinian people, who are now, and I'm not exaggerating, eating from the garbage heaps in Gaza, one of the poorest places on earth, where 75% of the people are living on less than $1 a day. When you announce a siege on such a people, this is a declaration of war against the Palestinian people. And I don't know why your country did that. It's absurd to think, as they appear to do, that Canada has anything to say to the government of North Korea when Canada is seen increasingly as the indissoluble ally of George W. Bush, who's making war throughout the world and who's in possession of 30,000 nuclear weapons pointed in all directions. It's absurd. It's absurd to think that by sending soldiers to kill people in Afghanistan, they keep telling me, these news interviewers, no, no, they're killing Taliban. How do you know they're Taliban? They got a membership card in their pocket. And Taliban kill me. I say to these reporters, who are increasingly young, so it's difficult to make this point, but I ask them to go and look it up. Every day during the Vietnam War, the American media would report the US Army's declaration that today they killed 100, 500, 900 Viet Cong. They weren't Viet Cong. They were just Vietnamese. And they're not Taliban. They're just Afghans that your soldiers and my soldiers are killing. You've killed a lot of Afghans. And the Afghans are starting to kill a lot of you. And you're making people hate you as a result. That, Mr. Harper, is an absurd foreign policy.
That's my honest opinion. But of course, it's not just that you're killing Afghans. By killing Afghans, you're relieving American soldiers to go to Iraq and kill Iraqis. And don't think that nobody has noticed. Don't think the Palestinians didn't know that it was your government who were the first to turn off the taps to try and starve them and punish them. Don't think the Muslim world doesn't know just how gung-ho a member of the coalition of the killing the Harper government is. Now, listen to this. Foreign policy is beginning to dictate the outcome of elections in powerful Western countries. Mr. Blair will be going soon, very soon. Remember, you heard it here, very, very soon. Mr. Blair is losing power in Downing Street very soon for one reason only, and that's his foreign policy infatuation with the George W. Bush government. Bush himself was given the mother of all beatings 2 weeks ago in the midterm elections, and not for any other reason than his foreign policy. Mr. Aznar in Spain is out because of his foreign policy. Mr. Berlusconi in Italy is out because of his foreign policy. Let's make sure in the next few months Stephen Harper is out because of his foreign policy. There is something else that's absurd. It's absurd that you've got an opposition party that wasn't losing any sleep over massacres of civilians in Lebanon, who declared that we will not mention the C word. Oh no, it wasn't the government, no. It's the opposition that wasn't losing any sleep. It was the opposition that wouldn't call for a ceasefire. For me, Harper and the Liberals are two cheeks of the same arse. I know about that, because we have such a system. We've got three parties. Tweedledee, Tweedledum, Tweedledee and a half. If it were anatomically possible, there would be three cheeks of the same arse. Now let me start. You thought I'd started, but I'm only warming up. Let me start with talking about what I'm not going to be talking about. If that doesn't sound too Donald Rumsfeld-ish. Wasn't it wonderful to see him go 2 weeks ago? I'm not going to be attacking the people of the United States of America. I am the great-grandson of probably the only woman in the entire 19th century who emigrated from America to Scotland when thousands were going in the opposite direction. I think she got on the wrong boat, and that's what happened. It's very important that we make it clear that in our attacks upon the policy of the United States, that not only are we not attacking the people of the United States, we salute them for finding their way through the fog of war propaganda and Fox News to the truth which delivered that beating to Bush and the neocons just 2 weeks ago. And I always have to be careful because I never know which Americans are going to be in the audience. A couple of weeks ago I was speaking at the London School of Economics and I made my usual gag that I didn't mind having a special relationship with the United States of America. I just didn't want a special relationship like the one Miss Lewinsky had with President Bill Clinton. If we weren't in a church, I'd pursue that metaphor further. But a young man put his hand up at the back of the hall and asked me if this wasn't a little ungallant, as not only was Miss Lewinsky a student at the London School of Economics, she was sitting in row 17 of that very meeting. So I did what few politicians do. I made a swift unqualified, and I hope gracious apology and promised Monica I would never tell that gag again. Another pre-election promise broken.
And with the Monica Lewinsky story to end all Monica Lewinsky stories, we'll take a brief break for a musical interlude and then return to George Galloway. Well, as long as we're having this 2006 nostalgia trip, here's David Rovix performing live at the University of Connecticut, April 2, 2006, singing about the year's favorite American vehicle.
Here it comes, driving down the center lane, like a cross between a tank and some kind of trackless train. Towering over anything with only four wheels to the pavement, cruising from shore to shore. Radar on the dashboard and the red, white, and blue streams from the antenna and the bumper stickers too. 4 tons of molten metal just to get a cup of coffee, ready for the battle in whatever suburb it may be. It's another Hummer humming down the highway. See the soldier change his tire, stranded by the road. Maybe that yellow ribbon is some kind of secret code, 'cause the Hummer drives on by with a passing stare, saying, I support the troops, but don't expect me to care. It's another Hummer humming down the highway. All the way to the shopping mall. How to say f*** you to the Kyoto Protocol. The only thing it's missing is a machine gun turret, but it still looks to me like a military target. It's another Hummer humming down the highway.
Going to be talking about is badly about the armed forces of your country, my country, or the United States of America. I often am greeted by protesters outside meetings like this who hold up placards that say, we support our troops. Well, it's a funny way to support your troops, sending them to get killed for a pack of lies, for a pack of liars. We're the ones who support our troops. We're the ones who want to support our troops by bringing them home for Christmas and keeping them here in our own country to defend us. The troops are lions led by donkeys, like Harper, like Blair, like Bush, like Howard in Australia. People who've never heard a shot fired in anger themselves. People who are not sending their own sons to kill and be killed. None of these columnists and broadcasters are queuing up at the army recruiting offices themselves, picking up their own tin hats and their own guns. They send other people's sons off to war. They're chicken hawks, ready to fight to the last drop of somebody else's blood for exploitation and domination around the world. The third thing I'm not going to be talking about, and this is important to say in North America more than anywhere else, because here there is still a gigantic taboo about what I'm going to be talking about tonight, where people are routinely intimidated into silence, into forswearing to tell the truth. But when I attack Israel this evening, and when I attack Zionism this evening, none of it should be confused with the foul strain of racism called anti-Semitism. Nothing that we say is against Jewish people. There are thousands of Jewish people in our movement. You don't have to be a Zionist because you're a Jew. And you don't even have to like Jews to be a Zionist. Anybody who thinks George Bush and the Christian evangelical Bible-belting hypocrites of the Christian right in the United States like Jews have never visited their country clubs. This is a very important distinction to make. Nothing that we stand for implies any hatred or animus towards Jews. It's Israel and its policies of oppression and aggression and violence that we hate, not Jews. Now I want to start with that point because it's the heart of the matter. It is the flaw at the heart of Western policy towards the East. It's the biggest source of hatred and bitterness in the Muslim world about us, about our injustice, about our double standards, which are clearer and clearer for all to see. I gave an interview during the Lebanon War early on a Sunday morning. Hardly anybody saw it on Sky News, which then went round the world. Thanks to the internet. As you just showed me, millions of people have seen this interview now, tens of millions in fact, thanks to the wonders of the new age that we live in. But the exchange was memorable for a number of things, quite unexpectedly. When I went into the studio, I had no idea that this would be anything other than a normal television interview, of which I do several every day. But I was particularly angry. My interviewer was particularly stupid. And some particularly dramatic things were happening on the other half of the split screen whilst I was speaking. But it was memorable most for this. This interviewer, and she is not alone, knew the name, the full name, the rank, and probably the serial number of all the Israeli soldiers she said had been, and I quote, kidnapped in Gaza and in Lebanon over the preceding few weeks. But when I challenged her to name one, just one, of the thousands of Palestinian and Lebanese victims who had fallen in the same period, she was completely dumbstruck, unable to give me a single name. And that shows the double standard. You see, Israelis have always got names. Americans, Canadians, British people have always got names. We hold 2 minutes silence for them. We erect memorials for them. We mourn them as we should. But we don't even count, never mind naming, the victims of the others. That's the truth of it. The blood of some people in this world is more valuable than the blood of others. And that's the shame. That's the real shame in this world. When Mrs. Blair and Mrs. Bush gave a simultaneous radio cast on the anniversary of 9/11, a synchronized swimming in the grief of that anniversary, it's bad enough that their husbands are in bed with each other. When their wives join them, it becomes positively obscene. And they asked us never to forget the heartbreaking messages of farewell left by those poor American women on those planes on 9/11 from their mobile telephones on the answering machines of their families. As if we could forget them. But as I said in Parliament afterwards, just because Afghan women don't have mobile telephones and Iraqi women don't have answering machines, it doesn't make their deaths any less obscene than the death of those American women on those planes on 9/11. Now that for us is a truth self-evident. But for the powerful people who rule the world, it isn't true at all. General Powell, when tasked with the question, how many Iraqis have we killed? He said, we're not in the business of counting dead Iraqis. Just as well, because They've now reached a level beyond counting. They're not in the business of counting dead Iraqis, no wonder. But the truth is, they're not counting them because they don't consider them human beings on the same level as us. That's why they can lay waste to a whole country, to country after country, and claim that that's just collateral damage, like so much crumbling and fallen masonry. But the Palestinian issue is the heart of this, is the center of this. And if you don't begin to grasp that in North America, here and in the United States, it's a truth that I must tell you has been grasped almost everywhere else in the world. The Palestinian people are the victims of one of the greatest injustices in all human history, at the hands of Israel, paid for by the United States of America. That war that we talked about in Lebanon, every aeroplane, every warship, every tank, every shell, every rocket, every missile, every bullet, every gun, every salary of every Israeli soldier was paid, every cent, by the taxpayers of the United States of America. That's very, very important to know. Israel dropped 4 million cluster bombs on Lebanon. 3/4 of them in the last 72 hours when the ceasefire had already been agreed. And 1/4 of these cluster bombs did not explode and lie there now like landmines in the orchards, in the fields, by the roads of the south of Lebanon, a tiny part of a tiny country. Since the war, quote, finished, 80 Lebanese children have been blown to pieces by these cluster bombs. The Lebanese farmers must make the decision whether to go into their fields and plant, risking their limbs and their lives with these landmines lying there, or to leave their fields barren with no harvest next year. Every one of those bombs was sent by the United States of America. Every one of them was transshipped through my country, through our airports, and shipped to the Israeli Air Force to be dropped on the Lebanese people. And Mr. Ignatieff didn't lose any sleep. But of course, as I pointed out in that Sky News interview, this story didn't begin 4 weeks ago, or 4 years ago, or 14 years ago. My daughter is 24 years old. All 24 years of my daughter's life, Israel has been invading and occupying Lebanon. And these idiots think it began with the kidnap of 2 Israeli soldiers 4 weeks before.
Thanks for listening. New World Notes comes to you from the spacious underground studios of WWUH-FM, a community service of the University of Hartford. For the Galloway speech, our thanks to Alex Smith, the Brown Bagger, and radio station CFRO in Vancouver. New World Notes is available in many ways. For more information, start at the blog, http://newworldnotes.blogspot.com. The opinions expressed in this program do not necessarily represent the views of anyone except me and George Galloway. From darkest New England, this is Kenneth Doust, wishing you a good week and advising, illegitimi non carborundum, keep the faith, and, to paraphrase Phil Berrigan, let's see if we can live each day as though the truth were true. Ciao!